we went forward as fast as we could. It wasn't very fast, of course, in those days. About 6 miles an hour, I suppose. We got to the German lines, and then we got onto the wire. The wire before you got to the lines, you see. And it was terrific, terrific wire. Pretty great in depth and height, 15 or 16 feet in depth, and about 9 foot high in places. It was under fire, but not so much, because they were taken so much by surprise. And to see these things coming towards them, a lot of the Germans got down into the dugouts, you see. We sort of picked them off as we went along. When we got through the line, they were shooting along the German trenches, you see. They came along the front, went like that, and then they were shooting right along, keeping them underneath. And the infantry, of course, were coming on behind. So the infantry mopped them up. I should think we were about the third tank. As far as we know, you never knew what was it, how many tanks. You didn't know what tanks were in. You couldn't see, you see. You could see nothing except just that little bit where the gun goes out. You could see nothing else when you're inside the tank. The officer and driver would... They could see where they were going, but they had only a very small slit for that, because they'd have been wiped out with a machine gun or anything like that in the front. Yes, they're limited just along the sights of the gun, more or less, you see. All we see was their trench, more or less. You couldn't tell whether you were shooting at anybody or not when you first went in, you see. You fired generally along their trenches. On each side, you're firing each side.
It's dawn on the 20th of November 1917, and the British Third Army have launched a massive attack towards the Hindenburg Line, and beyond that, the German-held city of Cambrai. This was no ordinary attack, though. Tanks had been used the previous year on the Somme, but this was an assault using the largest number of tanks yet assembled. 476 tanks attacked in all on that autumn day 108 years ago. And the words you were listening to there were spoken by one of those men that was inside one of those tanks. His name was Eric Potten. He was describing the first few moments of that battle. In this episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, we're going to look at that Battle of Cambrai, but not, as usual, through the history books or the academic research, but through the eyes of the soldiers that were actually there, men like Eric Potten. And I'm very pleased this week as well to be joined by Neil Russell, a man who talked to us a few months ago about trench raids. And on his travels, he found himself in a cemetery that was used to bury mostly men that had died of wounds during the battle. And he uncovered one or two fascinating stories, and he's going to tell us those stories later on. Now, that first day, the 20th of November, was a remarkable success. That initial victory at Cambrai brought cheering crowds onto the streets of London, and church bells were rung in celebration. At last, an end to this bloody stalemate seemed possible, and everybody was feeling positive, especially after the frustrating and dreadful slaughter at Passchendaele, which had really only just finished. The Germans, a few days later, counterattacked and regained much of the ground they'd lost. Victory wasn't going to be possible for the Allies until almost another year. It's a part of the Western Front that is rarely visited by battlefield tourists, unless they've got some kind of family connection with Cambrai. But it was, I suppose, a crucial turning point during the First World War. The much celebrated success of the first day was to be a false dawn. But as with all of these set-piece battles throughout the Great War, everybody learned from the good and the bad things that worked, things that didn't, the sacrifices of the men that were badly wounded and died. All these things came together the following summer during that 100-day offensive. So many of these lessons had been learnt at Cambrai. And therefore, we mustn't forget it, mustn't we? And that's what this episode is all about, looking at the story through the eyes of the soldiers that were there. One of the features of this tack is that surprise was going to be even more important than it had been in previous battles. This area of the Western Front was chosen because it was ideal for tank. Open, rolling countryside, and it hadn't been damaged like the Somme and Passchendaele had. No major battles had been fought in this area. The objective was to break through those German lines and seize Cambrai, a city that was important for so many reasons. The tanks themselves had been brought in position behind the British lines by 5 o'clock on the dull, misty morning of November the 20th. They'd been secretly brought up to the front line on trains, travelling by night, and it turned out to be one of the best-kept secrets of the war. They were strung out along a 6-mile line, and it's said that many of the British infantry didn't even know they'd arrived or what the plan was. This is winter, or early winter, and it's 6:30 a.m. Dawn is about to break, and the British artillery started to bombard the German trenches. But they didn't do this, as they had done in previous battles, hours, days, or even weeks before the attack. This time, they launched the bombardment on the German trenches just 10 minutes, just shortly before 0 hour. And in fact, the tanks had already begun to move forward, crossing the British lines and heading into no man's land. The infantry followed, no doubt feeling really positive, because this time they'd got a big, hulking metal beast protecting them from the enemy machine guns and small arms fire. What was going on in the German trenches? Well, they must have been absolutely terrified, mustn't they? Many German soldiers ran away in panic before these metal monsters got to them. Others surrendered immediately. And within minutes of the beginning of the attack, these tanks were crashing through the frontline defences, flattening that barbed wire, bridging trenches, destroying machine gun posts, and leaving a path open for the infantry to follow. There was complete shock and surprise in the German lines, and by midday they'd broken through the first 3 trench systems of the Hindenburg line and penetrated 5 miles into the German-held territory. Success like this hadn't been seen before. 8,000 Germans had been taken prisoners and they'd captured more than 100 artillery guns. No wonder the church bells were ringing back home when news filtered through of what had happened. One of those tank commanders was a Captain D.G. Brown. And if you get a chance, buy a great book written by the author Brian Cooper called The Ironclads of Cambrai. And in there he quotes Captain Brown. The immediate onset of the tanks was overwhelming. The German outposts, dazed or annihilated by the sudden deluge of shells, were overrun in an instant. The triple belts of wire were crossed as if they had been belts of nettles, and 350 pathways were sheared through them for the infantry. The defenders of the front trench scrambling out of the dugouts and shelters to meet the crash and flame of the barrage saw the leading tanks almost upon them. Their appearance made them more grotesque and terrifying by the huge black bundles they carried on their cabs. As these tanks swung left-handed and fired down into the trench, others, also surmounted by these appalling objects, appeared in multitudes behind them out of the mist. It is small wonder that the front Hindenburg line gave little trouble. The great fascines were loosed and rolled over the parapet to the trench floor, and down the whole line tanks were dipping and rearing up and clawing their way across into the almost unravaged country beyond. The defenders of the line were running panic-stricken, casting away arms and equipment. Lieutenant McDonnell was an artillery liaison officer with the 4th Battalion of the Seaforth Highlanders, and he described the scene on the morning of November the 21st, day two of the attack. He said it was an extraordinary sight as we went over the ridge. We could see the whole valley and the attack coming down. Battalion headquarters was a flag stuck in the middle of a field, with a row of officers watching through field glasses. The infantry was advancing in lines and columns everywhere. Battalions in reserve were streaming up behind, and cavalry patrols going along the ridges. All the old shock troops were there, and quite apart from that, there was the astonishing sight of tanks advancing in waves and cavalry galloping across fields with drawn sabres. Seems almost too good to be true, doesn't it, when you look at those words now? After the stalemate of the first 2 years of the war, had they broken through? Had they found a new way of beating that enormous German army? Was it too good to be true? We shall see. So let's go back to that man, Eric Potten, who's inside one of those tanks on that first day at Cambrai. And here he explains the structure of one of those tanks. And he goes on to talk about what happened next to him.
Officer and NCO sat at the front driving the tank. You call it driving it. Of course, they only had levers, you see, for brakes, more or less, than anything. And machine gun, of course. They had a machine gun in the front as well. Then there were two machine guns on each sponson. Those were the big sides that held the machine guns or the six-pounders. They came out, you see. There were two machine guns each side. That's four machine guns, five machine guns, you see. There were two more gearsmen, and of course one of the gunners would help the gearsmen occasionally, you see, if they wanted to move quickly. And there wasn't much resistance at that time. We were under a lot of machine gun fire, but not to cause any casualties or anything, you see, really. Of course, they got some guns up later, I suppose, because that's why some of the tanks were knocked out.
And how did he feel being inside that great big iron monster? Was he scared?
No, I don't think we were. You sort of felt you were all right in the tank sort of thing. You never thought of anything else like that, did he? I suppose there must be a certain amount of excitement, naturally. Excitement and noise. And barbed wire flying past you and that sort of thing, you see.
So the battle went on. German-held villages fell. Progress was being made. This massive experiment was proving very successful. But of course, the British Expeditionary Force were encountering casualties along the way. In the small Somerset village of Castle Carey, Harry Barber was a Methodist minister, and he'd awoken on the nights of the 27th and the 28th of November. And he told his granddaughter many years later that he'd seen his youngest brother, Wilfred, who was serving with the York and Lancaster Regiment as a second lieutenant, a junior officer, standing at the end of his bed. He said that Wilfred spoke to him and said, "Don't worry, Harry, I'm fine." But he wasn't fine, because a few days later, the family received the telegram that told them that Wilfred had been killed in action. Harry, of course, was not entirely surprised when news came through of his death. And it's Wilfred's story that I want to focus on now. I've picked him out because I was asked recently to research his story for his family. And it's very unusual, because I went down to the National Archives in Kew, managed to find this officer's paper-based service file for British officers that served in the Great War. These records are in the National Archives. They're available to anyone to view who's got to read his ticket, and they haven't yet been digitised. So the only way you can see them is to make the journey down to South London. And that's what I did a few weeks ago. And the reason I say that the detail of Wilfred is unusual is because we know exactly where he died and what happened to him, because some eyewitness accounts in his file tell us so. and we can follow his journey. So who was he? Well, in 1911, he was 16 years old and living with his parents and siblings in Castle Carey. He enlisted in the city of Bath in Somerset in May 1915 when he was 20 years old. And his attestation forms tell us that at the time of his enlistment, he was working as a bank clerk, and he joined the North Somerset Yeomanry as a private soldier and was soon promoted to corporal. But in March of 1916, he applied for an officer's commission. In September of 1916, his commission was obtained, and then he went off for training, which took until March of 1917 to be completed. And that's when he was commissioned into the Yorks and Lancaster Regiment. At the time that he was commissioned, a senior officer said this about him. He says, "This man is a smart soldier and would give a good account of himself in the command ranks. His character is most trustworthy, belongs to a most respectable family." And therefore, that takes us forward now to the 27th of November 1917. He's commanding a unit that to attempt to clear the Germans from the village of Borlon. And they are part of the 62nd Division as they attack the village from the south. And on their right, other units are to attack the ominous dark presence of Borlon Wood. And even further on the right along the main road, the village of Fontaine. This was to be a tall order because all these positions were heavily defended still by the German army. When they reached the village, they found that shell fire had not damaged the German barricades. There were hidden field guns and machine guns, and they opened fire on the men from every side. They were attacking again with tanks, but 10 out of the 15 tanks that were deployed were completely destroyed. They fought ceaselessly for 2 hours, but at 9:30 a.m. the survivors had no choice but to withdraw. Their battalion had suffered 200 casualties. 47 of them had been killed, including Wilfred. None of them have a known grave, and they're all remembered on the Cambrai Memorial to the Missing. The following day, an officer from the battalion who'd survived the attack wrote up in pencil the battalion diary. He says, 2:30 a.m. attack. The battalion moved to assembly place for attack on Borlon in conjunction with tanks, forming up under heavy shell fire by the enemy. 6:20 a.m. 0 hour. The battalion, following the tanks through enemy barrage, penetrated the village. Machine gun fire was heavy on both flanks. Stiff fighting took place in the village. The enemy had erected barriers which prevented progress of the tanks. Owing to this and the enemy's powerful machine gun fire in the village, the battalion was unable to break through, and after suffering heavy casualties, was obliged to take up a position in the brigade original front line. Enemy shelling of these positions and the approaches was heavy and was methodical throughout the day. Casualties: killed Captain Hewitt, other ranks 17, 3 officers wounded, other ranks 172. Wounded and missing, it says, 2nd Lieutenants Ashton and W. Barber. Other ranks 6, missing Lieutenant Harrison, other ranks 40, accidentally wounded 1. So then we've got the mystery of what had happened to Wilfred. Battalion diary tells us that he was wounded and missing. And indeed, that's what a telegram said that went back to his family. It simply says, "Regret to inform you, 2nd Lieutenant Barber was missing and wounded on the 27th. Further reports will be sent if received." No further reports were received. And the next correspondence on the file is dated March 1918. So this is 4 months after he'd been reported and missing. And it says, "Dear Sir, I am directed to return herewith the correspondence you kindly forwarded to this department on the 7th of February last, relative to the death of 2nd Lieutenant Barber. I am to add that the death of 2nd Lieutenant Barber has been accepted for official purposes upon the evidence contained in the correspondence, and a letter in this connection has been sent to Mr. J.P. Barber. That's Wilfred's father. That letter had been sent to Harry, the Methodist minister. Wilfred's older brother had said he'd seen Wilfred, told him that he was fine. What were those letters that the War Office was referring to? Well, I've got one of them here in front of me, dated the 7th of February. It says, "Dear Sir, please accept my thanks for your last letter and your kind expression of sympathy in our great sorrow. I'm sending herewith all letters received which contain information concerning my brother's death. I fear the evidence is too conclusive to allow even a gleam of hope." And here are a couple of those letters that distinguished all hope that the family may have had that Wilfred was still alive. The first one is written by a private, Albert Hepley. He was writing from a prisoner of war camp in Germany. And in this letter, he was writing to his own parents. He says, "Well, dear mother, I think myself very lucky to be alive, for there's just three of us left out of 20 that went into the garden on the 27th of November, the morning of the attack. My boss, Mr. Barber, and another officer was shot down beside me, and I got hit in the hip and in the back of the head, which took my eyesight out for 2 hours. And when I could move, what was left of our lot had retired, and the Germans were all around the village, and I was in the centre, so I could do nothing but wait to be taken prisoner. And I was wet through to the skin for all the time that morning. It poured down with rain, and I had no coat on, only my tunic." Another soldier called Cooper was in a base hospital up at Etaples, that the British soldiers famous called Etaples. And he wrote this report on the 1st of December, just a few days after the action at Bourlon. He said, "Second Lieutenant Barber was in command of 15 platoon. He was wounded in the garden of a building in Bourlon village on the morning of the 27th between 7 and 8 o'clock. The building had German snipers and machine gunners inside it. I lay next to Mr. Barber after he was wounded. He never spoke. In about a quarter of an hour, he was shot through the head and killed as he lay there. I got back to our lines eventually." So from that report, we can see that Barber was indeed wounded. And as he lay there, who knows whether he was conscious or not. The correspondent says he didn't speak, but then he was shot again, this time through the head, and that's how he died, 15 minutes after he'd been initially wounded. And there's another letter here, which the family kindly gave to me when I was researching the story. Another soldier wrote this letter, another comrade of Wilfred. He says, "It is with the very deepest regret that I have to inform you that your son, Wilfred, was reported wounded and missing on the 27th of November. During an attack on an enemy village, he was hit by a machine gun bullet, and all of them in his little party that were with him were either killed or wounded. I very much regret I can offer no hope as to his being alive. Although he is reported wounded, I feel almost certain that he was killed outright. Your son was one of the most efficient and popular officers in the battalion, with both officers and men, and on the 20th of November, after his company commander had been killed, he took command of the company and was instrumental in capturing 2 machine guns and 68 prisoners. And his men loved him and would go anywhere with him, and we shall all feel his loss for a long time to come. He was one of the most gallant fellows I have met, and he has left a record behind him in the battalion which will be remembered for many a day. Please accept my deepest sympathy on behalf of the officers and men of the battalion and myself in your great bereavement. His personal belongings will be sent to you through a shipping company. If any further information I can give you, I shall be pleased to do so. So if you'll let me know. Yours sincerely, Lieutenant Colonel Hunt, Commander of the 2nd/5th Yorkshire and Lancashire Battalion." And using that information and Google Maps, it's easy to be able to follow his journey that day, because the village of Bourlon was rebuilt, and we can identify that he died, as the report says, as they tried to enter the village in the back garden of one of those houses. Houses that are in the same position. And one day, hopefully, I shall take Wilfred's relative to that place and be able to stand on the position where he was first of all wounded and then killed. And as I said earlier, none of those casualties that day have a known grave. He's still missing. He may still be there. Perhaps one day his body will be found and Wilfred can receive a full military funeral. Rest in peace, Wilfred Barber. Another soldier that I researched a couple of years ago was Private 45970 Tom Jones, who was serving with the 18th Battalion of the Welsh Regiment. And he died a few days earlier than Wilfred, on the 23rd of November 1917, the age of just 21 years old. And I mentioned Ball on Wood earlier on, and that's where the Welsh were attacking on that awful day. He's another one that has no known grave, and is also remembered on the Cumbria Memorial, Panel 7 in his case. In 1911, Thomas was 14 years old, and living with his parents and siblings. And a battalion diary tells us that on that day, they were to attack the German-held ridge in the far corner of the wood. And in the middle of the wood, there was and still is some crossroads. And that was to be their starting positions. Now, as we mentioned before, when talking about the woods on the Somme, any fighting in such a confined space is absolute hell. The fighting is hand-to-hand and vicious. And that's what happened on that day. Some of the units of the battalion that day had to cross 1,000 yards down a long slope, across a sunken lane and up the final rise into the wood. And all this time they were under shell fire, and that's before they even came across their enemy. After 3 hours in that wood, the Welsh units were through and occupying the northern and eastern ridges at the edge of the undergrowth. And we go back to that book, The Ironclads of Cumbria, written by Brian Cooper, and he tells us more of what happened that day. The attack was preceded by an artillery barrage, which came down on the edge of the wood and then lifted 200 yards at 10-minute intervals. 16 tanks of G Battalion had the task of helping the brigade to clear the wood, while 13 tanks of D Battalion were to lead another brigade in securing the village and the western shoulder of the ridge. At the last minute, the tanks of G Battalion failed to arrive, as heavy traffic on the roads had prevented their supplies of petrol and ammunition from being brought up to the front. And so the 4 tanks of D Battalion were switched to lead the right-hand attack by the 19th Royal Welsh Fusiliers and the 12th Battalion of the South Wales Borderers, with the 17th Battalion of the Welsh Regiment in support. Major Watson described the opening moves of the attack. Across the foreground ran the great high road from Bapaume to Cumbria. It was wide, perfectly straight and fringed with orderly trees. Beyond it and to my left was a low hill, which the enemy still held. Our line ran diagonally up the slope of it, and away to the west we were on the ridge. Immediately in front of me on the hillside was the great dark mass of Ball on Wood, square and impenetrable, covering the highest point of the hill and stretching over the skyline to the farther slope, which we could not see. The wood dominated the whole countryside, and beyond it there was nothing but low open country extending to the marshes of the Scarp. We could not live north of Havrincourt while the enemy held the wood, and if we captured the wood, there was nothing to prevent us from sweeping northwards to the Scarp or westwards into Cumbria. At the moment, our line ran along the southern outskirts of the wood and to the south of Fontaine, which their enemy held in force. At 10:30, the barrage fell and we could see it climb like a living thing through the wood and up the hillside, a rough line of smoke and flame. On the hillside to the left of the wood, we could mark the course of the battle, the tanks with tiny flashes darting from their flanks, clumps of infantry following in little rushes, an officer running in front of his men until suddenly he crumpled up and fell as though some unseen hammer had struck him on the head, and men wavering in the face of machine gun fire and then spreading out to surround the gun, the wounded staggering painfully down the hill and the stretcher bearers moving backwards and forwards in the wake of the attack, the aeroplanes skimming low along the hillside and sideslipping to rake the enemy trenches with their guns. We watched one tank hesitate before it crossed the skyline, and our hearts went out to the driver in sympathy. He made his decision, and the tank, brown against the sky, was instantly encircled by little puffs of white smoke, shells from the guns on the reverse slope. The man was brave, for he followed the course of a trench along the crest of the hill. My companion uttered a low exclamation of horror. Flames were coming from the rear of the tank, but its guns continued to fire and the tank continued to move. Suddenly, the driver must have realised what was happening. The tank swung towards home. It was too late. Flames burst from the roof and the tank stopped. But the sponson doors never opened and the crew never came out. Now, as far as Tom Jones goes and his Welshman, Cooper in his book says they fought desperately against being surrounded and were saved just in time by the arrival of the reserve battalion. After fierce fighting, the Germans began to fall back. As dusk fell, the Welshmen pushed on until they'd won the crest of Bourlon Ridge. Most of the wood was now in their hands. Only the slope in the northern side remained in German possession. Later, contact was made with the 14th Battalion of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, and after more reinforcements from the Welsh regiments had been brought up, a continuous line was formed from the top of Bourlon Ridge down to the 51st Division position south of Fontaine. The efforts of the 40th Division, that included Jones and his Welsh Battalion, despite the fact that the troops had never fought with tanks before, was the most successful of the day. But their ordeal was not over, because what do the Germans do in this situation when they've lost ground? They immediately counter-attack. And that's what's happened here. It started at 8:45 a.m. on both flanks, coming from the direction of Fontaine and Bourlon Village. Fresh German units made a determined attack on the wood. They were beaten off with heavy losses, but had no intentions of giving up easily. For 2 hours, the wood was shelled incessantly with high explosives and gas without let-up. It became a hell of torn trees, blazing undergrowth and broken bodies. Then at 11 a.m. came another attack, this time concentrated against the right. Again, this was repelled, but the Germans managed to establish a forward position on the eastern edge of the wood. British casualties were mounting now. The troops were outnumbered and battle-weary. But more attacks followed, particularly from the northeast, and on the right the line began to give away before the fury of the German assault. The remnants of the 17th Battalion of the Welsh Regiment became cut off in the northeast corner of the wood, but then the line of Welshmen, Highlanders and others fought back and succeeded in pushing the Germans down the northern slope of the wood, where they became caught in the British artillery barrage. It was a superhuman effort against superior forces, and although the Germans managed to retain possession of the northeast corner of the wood, after the cut-off Welsh companies had fought their way out, most of the wood and the highest ground was still in British hands at the end of the day. But at some stage during that day, Tom Jones was killed. And as I said, he doesn't have a grave. He may still be in that wood. A wood that's never been cleared and no doubt contains the bodies of so many of those Welshmen. And a couple of years ago, I took his relative into the wood and I read to him the story that I've just read to you. And he stood there silently, looking around, thinking, wondering. And he told me afterwards that he was wondering whether Tom knew that he'd come to see him. A question that so many people must ask themselves on battlefield tours, and a question that is impossible to answer. Captain D. E. Hickey was a tank corps section commander who'd previously seen action at Ypres and was to go on to play a part in the Battle of Amiens in the following year. But he was there in Cambrai that day. And he gives us an idea of the fear that the German defenders felt when faced with these tanks. Encouraged by our success, we clattered across the fields in the direction of Marcon. Just over halfway, we came across a farmhouse. It was a target not to be missed. The three tanks opened fire on it and disturb a nest of machine guns. After a short bombardment, one German officer and about 20 other ranks ran out, scattering in all directions. A number were successfully dealt with by our machine guns, but one, lying flat on the ground, appeared to be feigning dead. The tank driver, Corporal Dunn, thought he saw the fellow move. He looked suspicious. A hand grenade thrown against the track of the tank would probably damage a plate, and if it broke it, put the tank out of action. The front machine gun had got a stoppage and would not work. Hardy pulled out his revolver and the tank was driven towards the miserable victim. He lay so still that Hardy thought he really was dead. Dunn, however, looked through the porthole in front of him and exclaimed, "No, sir, he's not. I saw him blink. I'm sure he's got a bomb in his hand." I took a look through the front revolver loophole in our left sponson. The man was elderly, short and thickly set. He was lying right in front of the tank and almost on his face. His short, thick neck was wrinkled and weather-beaten. I closed the flap and the report of Hardy's revolver ended the incident. So that's enough of me talking about what happened that day. Let's now, as I said at the beginning, engage the help of Neil Russell. And he looked into a couple of unusual stories, or unusual men, shall we say, that were casualties of that Battle of Cambrai. This is what Neil had to say.
So Lord Seymour then, tell me about Lord Seymour. And did this come out of your trip? You went to the Hindenburg Line recently, didn't you? Is that?
Yeah, that's right. I went to look at the Cambrai battlefields generally.
Yes.
And I learned about him, heard of him, and then conducted some research surrounding him in my reading, preparing for that trip. So
yeah.
Lord Edward Seymour, he was an aristocrat. He was the son of the 6th Marquess of Hertford,
okay.
I think. Yeah, and the family seat's in Ragley, which is in Warwickshire. Okay. A proper old British aristocratic family. He was born in born in 1879,
yeah.
Something like that. And he was a bit of a rogue. He was very different to his brothers. Whereas one brother went into the Royal Navy, an officer in the Royal Navy, another went into the Grenadier Guards, the first foot guards, you know, the most senior, and perhaps arguably, I'm sure the Coldstream would have other ideas, but maybe the most prestigious regiment in the British Army. He was taken by drink. He became a bit of an alcoholic, and as a rogue, went to Canada as a young man. He was about 21.
So he's like the black sheep of the family, isn't he? I'm not sure we'll use that phrase anymore, but that's what we used to call it in the old days.
Well, that's the word I was going to use. going to use that word with no scruples, but I just couldn't find it in my dictionary. So thanks for that. So he was the black sheep of the family, and he had been to Canada at the turn of the century.
Okay.
And he was ranching there. Cattle farming at the time of the Boer War. When the Boer War broke out, being a young man, being this sort of rogue adventurer that he was, he enlisted in the Canadian Cavalry, went over to South Africa, and fought there. During the Boer War. So he had previous experience in the army. He then for a while was in the South African Mounted Police before going back to Canada and continuing farming up until the outbreak of the Great War. The outbreak of the Great War, he answered the old country's call. Lots of British men joined the Canadian Expeditionary Force, and then from the wider empire, there was lots as well that travelled back to Britain to join the army. And he counted himself amongst those numbers. He managed to get passage back to Britain, came to Britain and applied for a commission in the Warwickshires. Again, his aristocratic links, or contacts rather, smoothed that process. And in 1915, he gained a commission in the Depot Battalion of the Royal Warwickshires, a special reserve commission. Spent 1915 in England. He culminating in the end of the year, he's at Grantham at the newly formed Machine Gun Corps School.
Yeah. Belton House at Grantham?
Yes, that's right, yes.
Yeah.
He was court-martialed on New Year's Eve, or in early January 1916.
Is this drink again?
Drunkenness, exactly.
Yeah, New Year's Eve.
Why he wasn't dismissed then, I don't know, but he wasn't. He was exonerated, he retained his commission, and he went overseas and joined the 1st Battalion of his regiment in front of Beaumont Hamel and on the Redan Ridge prior to the Somme battle. In spring of 1916, again, he was drunk. Court drunk, and again he was court-martialed, and on this occasion he was dismissed,
right.
And dispatched home to Britain, sort of under a cloud of disgrace. On arrival, Lord Strathcona Horse were recruiting in Kent at the time, I think Shorncliffe, somewhere on that south coast there, and he went there and managed to enlist as a private soldier in the Canadian Army, or in the Canadian Cavalry rather, for his second stint with them. Again, went overseas very quickly
They wouldn't have
and spent.
known then, would they? When he's, they wouldn't have been able to link it together like we would on a computer these days. They wouldn't have known, perhaps, what his record in the Royal Warwickshire years.
I honestly don't know. I suspect they may have, and I suspect they may have overlooked it.
Yeah, because they needed
But
officers. Yeah.
no, he enlisted as a private soldier.
Oh, right.
And that's the extraordinary thing
Oh.
about this story is
Oh.
when you go out to the Western Front, you can go up and down the line anywhere you like and find in the cemeteries there are many people, many aristocrats of old and famous English families, and he's one of them. But yeah, he's a private soldier, and he served as such, a 38-year-old private soldier. I don't know if his headstone is unique, saying Lord. It says Lord on it and
Yep.
private. I don't know if that's a unique headstone, but it's certainly there's very few of them.
Yep.
Until he was killed at Cambrai. So he was killed on the 1st of December.
Right.
When the Germans had broken through on the 1st of December, the Germans did
Yes.
effectively a pincer move to pinch out the salient that had been formed by the Cambrai battle. He was operating in the south of the salient, in the area where the 55th Lancashire Division and the 20th Division had sort of had their front broken, and they were streaming back on places like Metz. And the Guards Division went up in concert with some cavalry units, one of them which being the Luftwaffe Horse. And he was conducting patrol work when he was shot in the head and wounded. He was sent back to casualty clearance station at, you're going to have to pronounce wrong, excuse my pronunciation, Rokingye Ekwenkwor. No, I
Oh
think it was
yeah.
number 48 CCS there. Yeah, where he died to come to his wounds and was buried there. And as I said, and as the photo you saw, it's quite a unique headstone to see a private soldier
Yeah.
and a lord.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
There's an interesting as well is his regiment, Strathcona's. They were working in, at the time of his wounding, they were working in concert with the Guards Division and actually one of the battalions in the division, the 2nd Grenadier Guards, who his brother Henry Charles had been in that battalion earlier in the war. And at the time of his death, only a couple of kilometres north in the direction of Gonneloo, was commanding a brigade of guards, the 3rd Guards Brigade. So yeah, you've got two brothers there in very close proximity,
Huh.
one commanding a brigade in perhaps arguably the best division in the British Army at the time, and certainly in one of the most prestigious infantry regiments, be it the Grens, and
Very
the other
important.
serving as a private soldier. And
Yeah.
as I said in my tweet that you saw, you know, I sort of wonder what his brother thought, really.
If he
How
knew,
quick?
if he knew he was there.
Yes, yeah. Oh, he did know he was there. I
Did.
know. Yeah, he did know he was there. I
Yeah,
know he
yeah,
knows,
yeah.
or he certainly knew he was in the army. I don't know if he knew that Lord Strathcona's horse was in close proximity, but he certainly knew that his brother was in the army.
And I
And
wonder if
yeah,
they had a relationship at all, the two brothers. Just don't know it, do
I
we?
don't know. Yeah, I
Yeah.
really don't know.
You'd like to
I
think
really
so,
don't.
but
Yeah, you like to think so.
yeah.
Yeah, Copper, his brother was called. He was called
Yeah.
Henry. But everyone in the army called him Copper. And just in our initial discussions about this, you said, oh, and a few other things you observed whilst
Yeah.
you were over there, and we were talking about what we might talk about. Buried not too far from him is a Lieutenant Horner in a Hussar regiment who his personal inscription sparked my interest because it was the same as Raymond Asquith's, which, yeah, really interested me when I saw that. His family was from a similar area to Asquith's in Somerset. You might have heard, you know, is it Wells Cathedral?
Yes.
Yes, there's an equestrian statue of Horner there, as well as a memorial to Raymond Asquith, the Prime Minister's son who was killed on the Somme the
Yeah.
year before.
Yeah.
Again, I just sort of speculated, really. I was chatting to friends, how did their two personal inscriptions come to be the same? You know, did they receive notice? Did they receive notice on the form that there was going to be a space for them to put their own inscription on their son's headstones the week of a church service? And did they get together at church, perhaps speak after a church service in that church and agree on using the same inscription? Or was it chance? Was it something that they both discussed and then both went away and independently decided? I don't know. I don't know the answer, but
Mm.
Lieutenant Edward William Horner died aged 28 years old on the 21st of November 1917. He was the son of Sir John Horner. He was educated at Eton and Oxford, and he was called to the bar. Joined the North Somerset Yeomanry in 1914, but was then transferred to the 18th Hussars in 1915, when he was seriously wounded in May of that year. He rejoined his battalion in 1916, having recovered from his wounds, but then, as we know, died on the 21st of November 1917, on the second day of the Battle of Cambrai. And the personal inscription that is the same as Asquith's reads this: small time, but in that small, most greatly lived, this star of England.
Yeah, it was interesting to see such a hard-hitting inscription for the second time over. And obviously, his grave is much less visited than Asquith's.
Of course. We'll have to see if we can change that. Again, the Cumbria, the Hindenburg line, so many people don't get out that far, but there's... it's a podcast in itself, which we'll have to do another time, but there's so much information, there's so many stories, you know, and there's so many little museums out there, and the Deborah Tank Museum and all those sort of things, and the crew that's buried in the cemetery just around. There's all those things that we'll have to look at.
I think that's the greatest thing about this subject for me. That is bottomless, isn't it? And you could spend your whole life to it and you would never get through it. There remains so much to be discovered.
He's right, isn't he? And thanks there to Neil. As I said before, I've got still dozens, if not hundreds, of podcast episodes noted down on my iPad. I think I worked out I'd have to live to be about 120 to cover everything that I want to talk about in the Great War. But we haven't finished yet. We haven't finished with the Battle of Cambrai, because we need to talk about what happened in the German counterattack, the big counterattack. The attack that day started at 6 a.m. and it was still dark. It was a massive bombardment against the 55th Division front, which opened so gradually. For a time, the British observers doubted that it was in fact a prelude to a major assault. But then the barrage grew heavier and spread along the whole front. Gas shells were mixed with high explosives, and by 7:05, when the first SOS signals were fired by British units in the front line, many casualties had been caused and all the communications with the rear had been cut. The infantry attack came at shortly after 7 a.m. Three full divisions of Germans launched against just one British division, that 55th Division. It was still dark, and there was a heavy mist when the first patrols came forward with light machine guns and flamethrowers. And at the same time, a large number of German aircraft flew low overhead, machine gunning and bombing the British defenders. Just like they were to do in the big spring offensive in the following year, the Germans were able to sweep through weak points in the British line and take the defences from the rear. Small pockets of resistance held out for as long as they could, or until their ammunition ran out, and then they were heard of no more. A description of the utter confusion that they experienced that day was written by an infantryman called J.H. Everest, whose company had already suffered casualties of 60% whilst being pushed back before the advancing Germans. This is what he said: "We'd retreated only about 2 miles when an officer suddenly appeared, shouting, 'It's not British to run away like this, boys. Let us make a stand.' If ever I felt like changing my citizenship, it was at this particular moment, for such an order stunned myself and the others he attempted to rally. We were on undulating territory, in a very exposed position, devoid of all cover, our ammunition completely exhausted, not the slightest chance of support for at least 24 hours, completely exhausted and undernourished. Furthermore, and on our heels were two fresh divisions of German troops, fully armed. We were in scattered groups of threes and fours. These scattered groups, the officers stopped and attempted to reorganise for a counterattack. At this time, approximately 60 surrounded the officer. We very quickly took in the precarious position we would be placed in if we stayed where we were until the enemy caught sight of us. At the best, they might give us a chance to surrender, but with such an officer in command, surrender was not his intention. We could not protect ourselves with our rifles, for the simple reason our ammunition pouches had already emptied themselves through attempting to stem the enemy counterattack a few hours earlier. Therefore, the only order the officer could command was fix bayonets and charge. Defenceless as we were without ammunition, ridiculously outnumbered, isolated, unsupported, completely exhausted and without the slightest cover, we would have been annihilated to a man. Neither would the slightest military advantage have been obtained after such slaughter. A rearguard action of this sort would be nothing short of madness. Therefore, we wisely decided to disobey this officer and continue to retreat to a more ensconced position. After the battle, I began to ask myself, could this officer who held us up have been a spy, dressed up as a British officer? He certainly could, for taking advantage of our badly broken front line, he could have easily penetrated into our lines with the precise objective of holding up the retreat, finally delivering us into the hands of the enemy. No British officer would have expected 60 unarmed men to stem the advance of thousands of well-armed troops unless some important military advantage could be obtained by their sacrifice. He may have been right, because later that same day, a German was found dressed as a British soldier in the British trenches. He was dressed as an officer. He was executed. So that's the story of the Battle of Cambrai. As I'm recording this, it's the 24th of November, halfway through the week before that German counterattack on the 30th of November. I've been to the Cambrai battlefields many times. It looks the same today as it did then. As you stand close to Havrincourt Wood, that's where the tanks lay hidden on that early morning in November. And then it slopes down to Grand Ravine, where there's a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery now. The village of Ribécourt is in the middle of the valley, and then the ground rises up to the Flequier Ridge, and that's where so many of the tanks were destroyed. In the distance, you can just about see the city of Cambrai and the three church spires. And then over to the left, high up, you can see that dense brooding wood of Bourlon that we talked about earlier. There are so many more stories to tell here. Stories of the men that were there. We'll have to return to their story at some stage in the future, because we've run out of time today. But if you do get the chance to go to Cambrai, please do so. And if you do, go to the Tank Museum in Flequier. And that's where you'll find a tank that they called Deborah, that was excavated in November of 1998. And in the cemetery close to the museum, you'll find the crew of Deborah. That's their final resting place. It's the tank's final resting place. And one day, I'm going to go and talk to the man that found that tank, and we're going to tell that story. So that battle in front of the city of Cambrai saw infantry, aircraft, artillery, even cavalry at some stages working together in new ways. And as we talked about earlier, those tactics were to be used with such powerful results at the beginning of the 100-day offensive in August of 1918. But this battle here at Cambrai in late November and early December of 1917 saw more than 80,000 casualties from both sides, men that were dead, wounded or missing. And if you do visit the battlefields, apart from visiting the tank at Flequier, you should really begin your journey at the Cambrai Memorial, which is along that main road mentioned in some of the accounts. It's the D930 road that goes from Bapaume to Cambrai. It's 13 kilometres northeast of Bapaume, and is actually 16 kilometres southwest of Cambrai. And the memorial stands on a terrace. Beneath it is the Louvrel Military Cemetery. That's a very small cemetery with just 124 First World War burials. But the reason why this site is so important is because of the Cambrai Memorial that commemorates more than 7,000 servicemen, including the two lads that we talked about today, Barber and Jones. These are men from the UK and South Africa who died in the battle and who have no known grave. The memorial was designed by Harold Bradshaw, and it was unveiled by Lieutenant General Sir Louis Vaughan on the 4th of August 1930. And there is another place which I highly recommend you visit in the village of Bourlon itself that we've talked about today. If you drive up the hill, keeping the wood on your right, you can see the southern side of the village on your left and the gardens where Wilfred Barber was killed. And then go down into the village and take a left turn. And the road will take you to a dead end. But on the left-hand side, you'll see what's left of the walls that surrounded the chateau that was never rebuilt. And these walls are full of damage caused by artillery and perhaps tanks, not just from perhaps 1917, but from the battles that took place here in 1918 when the Canadians finally took Bourlon and the wood next door. There aren't many places on the Western Front that you can visit where you can see remnants of the Great War itself. There's one particular big hole in the wall there. Whenever I take people there, we don't go there on coach journeys. It's not somewhere you can get to easily in a coach. You have to go there in a car, really. As I say, when you look at one of the big holes in the wall that was made by either a tank or an artillery shell, it's gone through that thick brick wall that has stood for hundreds of years, and you wonder what damage that artillery or tank shell could do to a human being. And then close to where you park, you can easily miss it, but there's an information board on the wall there, and it contains a photograph of a very young German soldier called Joseph Himmelreich, and he was 21 years old when he died here at Bourlon on the 25th of November 1917, aged 21. He came from a place called Westfield in Germany and was a member of the 21st Reserve Division, and he was engaged in one of the German counterattacks in this area when he was killed. 90 years later, after a ceremony in St. Martin Church in Bourlon, he was buried at the German military cemetery in Cambrai, behind that wall that contains that information plaque and a photograph of young Joseph. That's where they found his body. He's one man that's no longer missing. He's one man that's now found and has his own permanent place to rest. But for now, thank you once again for tuning in to the podcast. Please do continue to rate and review wherever you download it from. And as usual, we remember those men that died at Cambrai, British and Germans, by the sounding of the last post.